Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Landides. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us for today's show. On the episode today, we have Miguel Iturrate. He is a longtime matchmaker in MMA, and so we delve into some of his history. He actually helped book the first all-female MMA card back in 2002 for Hook and Shoot. So we talk a little bit about that. We talk about where he got involved with Bodog, which became Bodog Fight Promotions, basically, which entered into a kind of a shared promotional agreement with Strikeforce, and they actually co-promoted some events, such as the first Strikeforce event at the Playboy Mansion, which was the first ever MMA event at the Playboy Mansion. So we talk more about that. We talk about him booking Fedor versus Matt Lindlin in Bodog. That's an interesting story, as well as some other cool stuff. Talk about the podcast that he's doing today with Chris Lytle. So good stuff there. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right. On the line with us, we have Miguel Iturrate. Miguel, you have been involved in MMA for a very, very long time in an official capacity for close to 25 years, been a fan for even longer than that. You've made matches all over US, Canada, Asia, Europe, South America, North America, the Middle East. I mean, you've worked, sounds like, pretty much on all the continents in terms of MMA promotion. So Miguel, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you very much for having me, Phil.
Yeah. So I want to talk about just kind of your, let's start with that. How did you get involved in MMA? What kind of piqued your interest, and around when did you get involved as far as becoming a fan?
Well, like a lot of people from my era, I started watching, in about 93, 94, I started watching the UFC pay-per-views. I didn't see the first one, the very first one, but I did catch the second pay-per-view. And then from there, I think I went live to from 10 to 33. I attended every UFC.
Oh, wow. And you're a super fan.
Well, the thing is really quickly, it became more than that. You know, what I did is I met Jeff Osborne at the UFCs, and Jeff and I became partners in Hook and Shoot. And that's kind of the start of the whole thing. I went to a Hook and Shoot in July of 97. And if you look at it, it's a week after Tank Abbott fought Vitor Belfort. So the bug had hit. You know, I had been live to see the fight, the Belfort fight. And then the next week was Hook and Shoot. And I was like, I was going with a friend of mine who was married. And I was like, well, can you go next week? He's like, no, I can't do that. You know what I mean? I was like, I can. So I took off and drove 10 hours to Indiana and became friends with Jeff. And then, you know, eventually Jeff and I are really the partnership everyone talks about for Hook and Shoot.
Yeah.
From there, we kind of, I got lucky and was in the ground floor helping the Abu Dhabi people set up their tournaments. I attended the 99 Abu Dhabi, not the 98 one, but the 99. By 2000, I was actually organizing the judging and things like that. So, and we owned the rights to those videos. From there, we attracted the attention of a couple of sponsors. One of them was Dan Lambert. We were fortunate enough to work with him on Florida shows. And then Dan actually made a phone call to me at one point and said, hey, I got a friend in or somebody from Russia called me about doing shows. And that was a guy named Vlad. And Vlad is the person who signed the partnership with Bodog.
Okay.
Vlad was known for shows that are called MFC or Euphoria, and they were based out of Atlantic City. It's not to be confused with the other MFCs.
Yeah, the M1s. Canadian one. Yeah.
And then there's an M1 as well, like Russia. Like, so because he's Russian, people confuse him with a lot of shows, but he's responsible for about 8 pretty strong shows before Bodog, and that's what attracted the attention.
Okay. And you mentioned Dan Lambert. I don't know if you're a pro wrestling fan, but he is cutting some pretty tremendous promos on AEW programming right now. He's probably one of the best promo guys in AEW. He's not even part of the company. So, but yeah.
I'll tell you, briefly, I do a podcast myself on MMA history with Chris Lytle.
Right.
Nowadays. And that promo gives me hope that maybe I'll get Dan on as a guest before.
Oh, before man. Too long. I'm sure he'd be a fantastic guest.
And that's the thing is I, you know, out of respect to him, I wouldn't have asked him. But since he started to come out of, you know, in public a little bit, I'm going to ask him at some point.
Okay. Well, let me know when you do, because I'd love to hear that one. Well, you mentioned Jeff Osborne. You two, like you said, partnered up on Hook and Shoot, which was an extremely important, it's not a name that's really remembered today as it should be, but a very important promotion early on in the mainstream you know, acceptance or emergence of MMA. And you did the matchmaking for the first ever women's MMA card, which was for Hook and Shoot back in 2002. And this, of course, predated Strikeforce, really putting MMA on the mainstream map, as at least as far as the sport goes. So this is important. But what made you want to put together an all-female card? And then how did it go?
Well, I got to be honest with you. I'm at that time, I was more of a purist, and I am a matchmaker strictly for competition. Like, I didn't have, like, there was nobody on my roster that I also managed or tried to get fight. You know, I helped them get fights elsewhere, but I never took a piece of it, or, you know, and I would never, like, protect people or, you know, if they were going to make good money, they could go do the fight. And if they lost, I would deal with that, you know, bouncing them back or whatever. It's true matchmaking, not a business angle to it, right? So I was against the women's show. I didn't have enough fights for the men's roster. So, you know, at that point, you're doing 6 or 8 shows a year, and it becomes a little bit hard to, you know, keep everybody happy. And we were building a good roster, right? So it was Jeff's baby, and I'm glad that, you know, Jeff said, I'm going to do it anyway, or, you know, whatever it was. I was there. I was supportive. I guess I am the official matchmaker. But Jeff did a lot of the work there, and it was eye-opening. And how did it go? I'll tell you. I had been matchmaking at that point for 4 years, and we used to have a saying. We used to say on Wednesday of fight week, we'd say, okay, 3 things are going to go wrong at least between now and the show. You know, somebody's going to cancel. 3 people are going to cancel. Somebody's, you know, something's going wrong. So we were already hardened and prepared. And the women's show was the easiest thing that we'd ever done, because the women and the there weren't many women fighters, but the ones that were there were already, they had access to men and men training. They knew what the sport was about. They knew what they wanted. They were very focused. They were very glad to have the opportunity. Everyone showed up with medicals. Everyone showed up with their contract signed. Everyone showed up with pictures and headshots, and everything was done. And that's a little bit of the difference between men and women. The men, you have to chase them all down. Right. And still to, you know, to, till the end of days, we were chasing men around for their paperwork and stuff. But the women were so hungry for the opportunity. It was the easiest show. And after that, and great fights. So with that combination, then I could no longer, you know, just say, hey, I don't have enough fights. We just got to work them in. And ever since then, we started, you know, pretty consistently putting women's fights on all our cards.
Okay. All right. Well, that's, I mean, and like I said, it was ended up being essentially a precursor for what we would see a few years later. And I think in a lot of, I mean, I don't want to say that's, oh, there's a direct correlation necessarily, but I mean, obviously you needed those types of events to give female fighters the opportunity to get the experience they needed to get to the point where they could be in front of larger and larger crowds. So definitely an important moment in women's MMA history for sure. But let's shift a little bit. Let's talk about Bodog, because as you know, this podcast is about Strikeforce. There was a partnership between Bodog and Strikeforce, but going back a little bit, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the promotion and kind of what the vision for the organization was.
It was pretty chaotic, to be honest. you know, the bottom line is Vlad is, you know, with Dan Lambert, you know, and Jeff and even the Sheikhs from Abu Dhabi, the sponsors, so to speak, of the shows, always had a passion for the sport. They like the sport as well. Even the Sheik is, you know, it's not really about money for him. He does like the sport. He rolls and does things like that. Lambert is a black belt by now. He was a brown belt when I knew him. Vlad wasn't that. Vlad was a businessman, and Vlad liked the ostentatious nature of things, you know, doing things the Russian way and things. so it made it very interesting there. But it was Vlad that attracted the combination with Bodog in trying to take it big. And Bodog was, as I understand it, Calvin, the owner, was kind of into fights, and he liked fights, and, you know, he was making money by his online casino by the boatload. So he dedicated a bunch of money to his entertainment end, which was part of what I consider is the confusion of Bodog is Bodog Fight was under Bodog Entertainment, and Bodog Entertainment also involved like a whole music section. And you know, all, so like all the losses and things that are applied there, I'm told, like you hear like, oh, they spent X amount of money or whatever. A lot of that went also on music. They had, at the same time our show was on TV, they were on TV with a show, Battle of the Bands, and they were traveling bands around and spending money like that. So that was all going on under Bodog Entertainment, and we were under their Bodog Fight. So yeah, it was chaotic because there were times where, you know, the executives were on the music side and I was really the only fight person. And, you know, that causes a little bit of stress because I like to do things my way. and it's hard to accept, you know, being told, you know, doing things from by other people who don't know anything about the fight game, you know?
Yeah. Which has always been, whether it's MMA or pro wrestling or whatever, that you have people outside the sport that think they can make some money on it. And then they try to come in and do it their way. And it usually doesn't work. See Elite XC.
You know, see a million of us. So the problem with Bodog, for example, was first, I sincerely believe Calvin liked the fights. Like he liked, like he would have continued doing it probably as a sponsor if it could have been something that, you know, wasn't always running in the red. But the executives under them, you know, were not fight people. And I think that that makes a difference. You know, putting bans on MMA shows never works. And you, when you can't even suggest to them that, you know, we don't do that, because they're like, no, you can't talk to the execs about that. They want the band so bad. So, you know, little things like that, you know, you start to see there's going to be some long-term trouble with Bodog. But yeah, it was flashy. And I think if you look at the roster, that at least in terms of the roster was getting ready to compete at a higher level. And, and I think we attracted the UFC's attention. Like, they're very, like, we were, like, having fun and getting bigger and doing it that way. But the UFC was like, no, this is a business. And they were very cutthroat and we weren't ready for that. We weren't ready for that. That jump, we were bigger than we could handle in terms of protecting ourselves, getting pay-per-view time and things like that. So, like I said, it was a little chaotic.
Yeah. And it's a good segue when you talk about the fighters, because the list of really good fighters that, and as I say these names, not all, I mean, some of them were very early in their career and they weren't who they would become, but just the fact that you were booking this level of fighters, whether they're already established or not, you know, really shows the eye for talent, I guess the purity and the matchmaking, as you put it. It wasn't pride style matchmaking. You know, you didn't see, you know, giants fighting, you know, little people, basically. I mean, it was very obviously
don't get it wrong. Vlad made me do some of that.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, as I kind of look through the events, cause there's not a ton of Bodog fight events, but as I scanned through them last night, there were a few that made me go, like Fedor versus Matt Lindland is a bit of a mismatch.
Well, you know, I can tell you, I can elaborate about that fight. That's an interesting story.
Okay. Yeah. So let me finish these and the fighter names. And then I do want to ask about that. So, you know, Fedor, Lindland, obviously, Jorge Masvidal, Eddie Alvarez, Chael Sonnen, Hadra Gracie, Bigfoot Silva, Cain Velasquez, very early in his career, Roy Nelson, Jake Shields, Gegard Mousasi. I mean, that's not even everybody. I mean, Eve Edwards, there's a bunch of other guys that may not be big stars, but were, you know, very, very talented. So, you know, obviously you clearly had an eye for talent. So
Mike Brown, Mike Brown, Basler.
Yeah. I mean,
WWE.
Yeah. Yeah. She's done better in WWE than she did in MMA, but yeah, it just obviously great group of fighters. So first I just want to ask kind of what was your strategy behind putting that roster together? And then, yeah, I would love to hear a cool story about Fedor versus Lindland.
That roster had been together, put together over a few years, you know, many years, really.
Right. To be clear, that was not all on the roster at the same time. That was from the beginning of Bodog Fight to the end of fight. These are the fighters that stepped into the cage. So not, yeah, I don't want to mislead the listeners and think, oh, that's everybody that was there at the same time. Because obviously.
Well, a lot of those were, at Bodog, we did an event in Costa Rica that was 36 fights. It was 12 fights Friday, 12 fights Saturday, 12 fights Sunday. It took the UFC years to equal that. They did. They did three fights in a row. And I think it may have been because you know, I kind of said, hey, I've done a couple of things the UFC never did, like book Fedor and fight, you know, do three fight nights in a row. But anyway, so the point is that's 70 something fighters. That's a roster. That's 70 something fighters. That wasn't our whole roster that at that time. We probably had 150 fighters under contract. So it took a long time to get there. And you do pick and choose. I'm proud of the people that you named, because I do think if you look at it, it wasn't just like, hey, you know, he happened to do a drive-by. It's like, I booked Masvidal 20 times. You know, I booked Chael Sonnen at least 6 or 7 times. You know, I think the guys that we picked out for talent, you know, we carried, and that's what I was trying to do. I think that the people that, you know, were there, we were trying to build a very competitive league. So Gegard Mousasi came in, impressed. I don't think I was able to get him back, but you had to deal with the same people that I dealt with Fedor. So, right. You know, I think if we had stayed there, Mousasi would have been with us for a while. But when I left, I think the strategy changed at Bodog and at Strikeforce, and it became more Bodog sponsoring them with, like, you know, branding and things like that, and not becoming involved in matchmaking. So, as far as Fedor is concerned, the original phone call I had, it was with Randy Couture. It was supposed to be Couture and Fedor. And I actually had gotten a blessing to offer Couture $3 million for that fight.
Wow.
And I got that far with it. But Couture, he said he would have loved to do it. He said he would have liked to have gotten a hold of me or heard from me earlier, because he had just re-signed with the UFC.
And I assume that was during his he was in legal limbo with the UFC.
Yes. And when he came back on that run that he came back, that was like a 7-fight deal he signed. That's the deal he signed.
Ah, okay.
So I was late. but in that phone conversation, he says, but I have somebody who'll do the fight for you. And he handed me the phone to Lindley.
One of his team Quest brothers.
Yeah, so it makes sense there. At the time, Lin, you could argue, like, Couture and Fedor is 2 top 5 guys, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's a dream fight.
I think at the time, you could argue that Lin was top 25, maybe, you know? So I don't think it was, you know, the worst of fights. And the fact is Lin is such a competitor. He talked me into it. He did.
I'm sure he really
want that fight. And I think he wanted it beyond the money. He made good money, but I think he also is the type of competitor that wanted that. I think Team Quest, you know, Chael, Dan, Henderson, I think they saw Fedor as like a challenge amongst themselves. So I think Lindland made for about the most interesting fight. But back up, the second guy on that plan was Munson. And the third guy was Roy Nelson.
Okay.
So that's the way it worked out, and we went with Lindland. You know, I Fedor sort of thought it was going to be an easy fight, and somewhere along the line, I got a call from them, and they said, you know, Lindland's no easy fight, and I was like, well, he's a middleweight, you know.
Yeah.
What more you want me to give you?
Yeah, I mean, my issue with is not necessarily, it's not the skill level, because I respect Lindland as a fighter for sure. I mean, he was definitely a challenger, but as you just said, he was a middleweight, you know, so fighting a middle heavy is just, it doesn't matter the skill level, that's just going to be a really, really difficult fight. And when
he
it's
told me he walks around at 210 at the time, so okay, cut to 185, so
and Fedor was not a huge heavyweight, so it makes it a little easier. But I mean, you're talking about the greatest heavyweight, and I'm not trying to take shots at you. I'm just saying that it just on paper, it's not a competitive fight just from a weight perspective, but from a skill perspective, yeah, Lindland's a Greco-Roman silver medalist in the Olympics, and you know, very, very tough and durable guy. So yeah,
you know, when you have you got to go with what, like, you know, I couldn't get, you know, Alexander, you know, I couldn't get some famous name. I had certain, you know, capabilities, and Lindland was the most interesting. The fact is, in the fight, Lindland got wronged. You know, the ref who I love made a mistake and really didn't warn Fedor, and Fedor really tied up on top. Fedor Lindland had a body lock on Fedor, and he's an Olympic Greco medalist, you know, so you assume he's in a good position. And Fedor used the ropes to stay up for at least three different times. And then he orchestrated the takedown like he wanted, because, you know, he's Fedor. He's not bad at takedowns, so he got Lindland. But Lindland bloodied him in the first punch. Fedor backs off, checks his forehead with his hand, looks at it because he's bleeding. And then he's caught in an upper body lock with Lindland clinched up, right, up with his arms. He should have been taken down. And the ref made a mistake and didn't warn Fedor or say anything. He just warned him, didn't break him up, didn't do anything. And then Fedor got the takedown on Lindland. So it was an interesting fight, but I heard a lot about it from Matt and his manager and his lawyer. So, that's probably the biggest fight we did, too.
Okay. All right. Well, I got a few more questions. We're starting to kind of run short on time. So I do want to get to these, but as we mentioned, Bodog entered into an agreement with Strikeforce, a co-promotional agreement in 2007, did some events together. Although, as you said, eventually became more of a type, like a sponsorship branding type deal than it did actually partnering together on the events. But you did the matchmaking, if I understand it correctly, for the first ever MMA show at the Playboy Mansion, which we've covered on this podcast. And I'll just quickly run down the main card for that, but opening bout, Jorge Masvidal defeated Matt Lee via TKO. Billy Evangelista defeated Clint Cornell via split decision, in which was a very entertaining fight. Josh Thompson defeated Adam Lin pretty quickly. And if I remember right, Lin tested positive for cocaine after the fight. Joe Riggs defeated Eugene Jackson in what was a pretty tough fight. And I interviewed Riggs on this podcast afterwards. He talked about how it was difficult to beat up Eugene in front of his boys, since they were in the front row, I believe. Gilbert Melendez defeated Tetsuji Kato via unanimous decision in the main event. Bobby Southworth defeated Bill Mahood via verbal submission. Mahood had hurt his ribs pretty quickly in the fight, and that was the end of that. And I believe Mahood also tested positive after, I think he blew positive afterwards. But, you know, an entertaining card. There was some really good fights on that card. It's an interesting atmosphere at the Playboy Mansion. They ended up doing one more show there, but what do you remember about the event? Anything interesting or noteworthy jump out in your mind from the event?
Well, wasn't Trevor Prangley on that card?
He was on the second one. He was not on this one.
There may be some confusion there. As far as I understand, the September 2007 Playboy Mansion show, I did some of the matchmaking for that. Like,
yeah, I mean, looking at the fighters, I could see, like, obviously Masvidal, like, you could see where you would probably book some of them, and then like Coker books some of them on their side.
Yeah. However that deal worked out, or wherever the other matches came from, you know, we all went through the commission and stuff, but I only matchmade. That's why I'm pretty sure they may have a mix up there, because I'm pretty sure Trevor was there, because that was my last show with Bodog. After that, they stopped. You know, we had been to Russia, we had been to Costa Rica, we had done a big TV shoot in Vancouver as well, kind of as a home base place. And that was the end of that part of the Bodog stuff.
Yeah. So let me, I quickly looked this up. So Prangley was actually in the main event of the second one. It was September 20th, 2008. He defeated Anthony Ruiz in a unanimous decision, which was a rematch. I don't know. You may or may not remember. There was, I think it was like the second or third Strikeforce event where Ruiz got caught in an armbar and the ref stopped it because he looked to be in a bad position and he was really upset. And so they did a rematch. But yeah, so Strikeforce at the Mansion 2 was September 20, 2008. That was Prangley and Ruiz in the main event. Mitsuhiro Ishida versus Justin Wilcox. Terry Martin defeated Corey DeVella. Josh Thompson beat Ash Bowman, and Kazuo Misaki defeated Joe Riggs. So they did September 2007 and then September 2008.
Okay. Yeah, that 2008 fight shows is all Strikeforce. That was not me. 2007 was, I may be confusing the card too, after that I left. And after that, I think Bodog had a couple of commitments. But the thing about Bodog, too, was that Calvin had, like, an image. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, like, they were like, I was like, why are we, you know, doing the show in Costa Rica? They wanted to do it outdoors. I was like, I don't want to do fights outdoors. You know, there's so many X factors. It turned out to work out very well. We had three beautiful days, and it none of the fighters had problems with the outdoors. So it was okay, but it was like – little things like that. They wanted to be ostentatious on the TV show, if you remember it, with models and, you know, all the kinds of stuff that they were trying to do. And then, you know, we're at the Playboy Mansion, which seems fine. And then after that, we were back in Evansville, Indiana. And that, to me, I mean, I've done 40 shows in Evansville, Indiana. That's fine if you got to go back to your roots. But it didn't seem like it was going to go along with Bodog because it just isn't a match. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was my feeling on it. But they fired me. So it's not like I left.
That Playboy Mansion show, though, again, I watched it on, you know, in preparation for the podcast episode that we did, covered it, and, you know, again, talked with Riggs about his involvement with the second one. Just, he actually mentioned he got bit backstage by a huge bird, and just what it, you know, kind of weird but interesting atmosphere that it was. So it's not very aesthetically pleasing, especially by today's you know, standards and you know, what we graphics and all that stuff and presentation, but it was a very interesting idea. And I, you know, it was interesting for what it was. So, but as you mentioned, Bodog was, you know, continued on with fights, discontinued its MMA operations in 2008. But let's, you know, as we wrap things up, you've continued to be involved with MMA. What are you up to today? And then, tell us about the podcast with Mr. Lytle.
Well, thanks a bunch. You know, I booked Chris a bunch in the early days. He's from Indiana, and that's where, you know, Hook and Shoot was based. So he's known me for a long time. We actually negotiated while he was with the UFC for him to come to Bodog. And, you know, when Bodog didn't last, you know, he made the right choice for himself. So that was good. But we remained friends, and he wanted to do something for history. He's been doing, the bare knuckle boxing stuff, like commentary for bare knuckle boxing. And he's been, you know, going to the shows again and meeting fighters. And at this point he's retired, but, you know, you stand and you're shooting the shit and, you know, talking and telling stories and stuff. And that's where he got the idea. He was like, you know, if we don't do something, some of these stories and some of this stuff is going to get forgotten. So he called me, and he called a promoter named Mike Davis out of the Midwest that, we call him the MMA detective, and the three of us are kind of doing a history podcast on the old days. So
what's the name? What's the name of the podcast?
It's called Lights Out, LYTES after Chris, Lights Out podcast. It's available on iTunes and YouTube. It's on a free YouTube channel. They're all out there free. So
cool.
Anyone can go there. It's usually, you know, we do a bunch of clips and stuff, but the strong point is, you know, 2 or 3 hour interviews with retired fighters. Just going into their career and the smaller fights and memories and stuff. So it's definitely a good time, and it's for the hardcore fans.
Okay, cool. Well, if you come across any Strikeforce fighters that you think would want to talk about their career, throw them my way. I'd love to chat with them. We've had, you know, Frank Shamrock and Kung Lee and Josh Thompson supposed to be on eventually, but Gilbert Melendez, Jake Shields, we've had tons of guys, and we've got some more guys lined up, but I'm always interested to talk to people that have had some involvement with Strikeforce. So,
sounds like I need to go to you for interviews.
I'm happy to connect if needed, but,
yeah, let's do that. But for now, thank you very much for this time, because, definitely a fun conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, one more question before you go. I always like to ask, what is, you know, when I talk to a fighter, what's your, you know, what was your favorite fight, you know, that you participated in? But for you, would it be Fedor Lindland? That's your favorite fight that you made? And if so, why?
I prefer to talk about the old Aaron Riley, Eve Edwards,
okay,
rivalry.
Yeah,
that's
a good, had. That's, man, they had, yeah, great. That's a good call right there.
Because, you know, we booked that in the 90s, the first version of that fight, and it was in Texas under Pancrase rules. And that fight, you know, had a couple of things against it. First, in Texas, we're not a promotional powerhouse, so there was not a lot of people there. And then under Pancrase rules, it makes it a little less appealing, especially back then in a no-holds-barred world where almost anything went. But the guys are, you know, were future, you know, they were mixed martial artists even back then, so that fight actually holds water and is a spectacular fight that you can still watch. And then Aaron took time off, went to train with Matt Hume, and we took time off to put together the rematch, and the rematch was in Indiana under MMA full, you know, closed fist rules. And that rivalry and that story, it's not like a rivalry where they hate each other. They love and respect each other, but that rivalry and Jeff as a promoter, storytelling and things like that, that was one of our highest moments. And it's a story and fighters that could be watched today and not look like, you know, Steve Jenham.
another callback there. Nice. All right. Well, Miguel, I appreciate you taking the time to be on Inside the Hexagon. It was great kind of diving into the history and a little bit more of the backstory of Strikeforce and then just some other parts of MMA history. But thanks for taking the time to be on the show.
Sure. No problem. And thank you very much for having me, and take it easy. Thanks to everyone out there.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, Miguel Iturrate, for taking the time to join us for today's episode. Appreciated all the insight, all the stories that he shared. Got some really cool experiences within the sport of MMA, and I appreciate him taking the time to do that. Make sure that you check out Lights Out, the podcast. It sounds like it's really an interesting one, especially if you're a hardcore MMA history fan, and if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are. So make sure that you go and check that out. Make sure you're also checking us out on social media. You can find us on Instagram and on Twitter at The Hexagon Pod. And then, of course, as always, you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to hear your feedback. Would love to hear more from you. Looking ahead, we're going to be covering Strikeforce Diaz versus Cyborg, which is a really, really interesting fight. Nick Diaz defending the Strikeforce welterweight championship against Cyborg Santos. Also on that card, Ronaldo Jacare Souza defends the middleweight title against ruthless Robbie Lawler. Herschel Walker makes his return and makes his final appearance in MMA. And then Hodger Gracie takes on Trevor Prangley. So that should be an interesting fight to cover. So I'm looking forward to that. Hope that you are looking forward to it as well. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Pit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on.